This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
This is the Washington Post for Saturday, the 27th of April. I'm Dave Abbott. The lead story, secrets, lies, and payoffs laid bare in week one of Trump trial testimony. Witness takes jurors behind the scenes of tabloid negotiating, mentioning Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, and Jeff Sessions. This by Shayna Jacobs, Tom Jackman, Derek Hawkins, and Devlin Barrett. Donald Trump fought mightily before and after he was elected president to keep secret the embarrassing details of his private life, but often failed, despite having a fat checkbook and a well-connected tabloid editor in his pocket, according to the first week of evidence at his trial. Former presidents typically spend their post-White House years writing memoirs, making well-paid speeches, and cementing their place in history. By becoming the first former president to face criminal trial, Trump is instead sitting in court, watching someone else try to define his legacy even as he campaigns for a second term in the Oval Office. Over 4 days of testimony this week, former National Enquirer executive David Pecker told the jury not just how deeply involved Trump's team was in using the supermarket tabloid to fuel his 2016 presidential campaign, but also how celebrities and politicians generally try to buy, trade, or bully their way out of scandalous stories. Prosecutors tried to show that Trump was acutely aware of the machinations being made on his behalf by the tabloid executive and Michael Cohen, Trump's former lawyer and fixer. After Pecker's testimony concluded Friday, jurors heard from Trump's longtime assistant and Cohen's former banker. Evidence shows Cohen paid $130,000 in hush money to adult film actress Stormy Daniels shortly before the 2016 election to buy her silence about an alleged sexual encounter she had with Trump's years earlier. Trump is on trial for allegedly falsifying business records related to his reimbursement to Cohen of that payment. Prosecutors allege he categorized the payments as a legal fee rather than a campaign expense to keep it from public disclosure forms. The transactional tabloid dynamic was spelled out in raw terms in text messages sent by Dylan Howard, one of Pecker's top deputies and a former National Enquirer editor. The most pointed of those messages were presented to the presiding judge, New York Supreme Court Justice Juan Merchan, but probably won't be seen by jurors because Howard is in Australia and, for health reasons, cannot appear at the trial to testify. Information is powerful, and I am collecting a lot, said one text from Howard to a close relative in June 2016. At the time, Howard had been assessing the credibility of various people who came forward with scandalous stories about candidate Trump. Mind you, in the event that he's elected, it doesn't hurt the favors I have done, provided it's kept secret, Howard texted. At least if he wins, I'll be pardoned for electoral fraud. For years, Pecker told the jury, he and his friend Trump, then a reality TV star, had a mutually beneficial relationship that involved information sharing in the celebrity world. When Trump decided to run for president, that relationship kicked into overdrive as the supermarket gossip sheet published glowing stories about the brash tycoon and ran many other stories pummeling his political rivals. Yet the first week of trial testimony showed the arrangement was far from foolproof. Just 4 days before the 2016 election, the Wall Street Journal revealed that the Inquirer had secretly paid a Playboy model, Karen McDougal, for the rights to her story about an affair with Trump. The Inquirer then refused to publish the story, a practice known as catch and kill. After the Journal wrote about the arrangement, Trump called Pecker furious. "How could this happen? I thought you had this under control," Trump said, according to Pecker. He was very agitated. At the time, Pecker's company publicly denied buying McDougal's story to keep her quiet. After being granted immunity from prosecution, however, he testified that that was precisely what he had done. Cohen promised him he would be reimbursed for paying McDougal, Pecker said, but his lawyers warned him later that such compensation was potentially a crime and that he may have already broken campaign finance law by paying McDougal. And so, Pecker testified, he balked at paying again when a lawyer for Daniels came forward to sell her story of a sexual tryst with Trump. "I am not purchasing this story. I am not going to be involved with a porn star, and I am not a bank," Pecker said he told Cohen. Trump ultimately instructed Cohen to pay Daniels $130,000 for her silence, according to evidence from this case and a previous federal investigation. The resulting reimbursements are the reason Trump is now on trial for 34 counts of falsifying business records. He has pleaded not guilty. The Manhattan District Attorney charges that Trump wanted such stories suppressed to aid his presidential campaign, particularly after the Washington Post reported in October 2016 that Trump had bragged on tape about grabbing women by their genitalia. Trump's defense team has argued that most of what the prosecutors are showing the jury is not criminal conduct, saying that if any crime was committed, it was by Cohen, not Trump. Prosecutors say Trump's primary motive in keeping the scandalous stories quiet was to help his campaign, but evidence they elicited from Pecker shows Trump was still trying to keep those secrets after he won the election. Trump also worried about boxes of documents about him that the Inquirer had acquired over the years, Pecker testified. The executive tried to reassure his friend and Cohen that the boxes of files were harmless, just a collection of old news stories. Nevertheless, at a meeting at Trump Tower in late 2016, Cohen pressed Pecker to let him go through the boxes. Pecker refused, he said. At the same meeting, Cohen complained to Pecker that Trump had yet to reimburse him for the money he had paid to Daniels and that he also hadn't received his Christmas bonus from his boss. "He asked me to speak to Donald Trump," Pecker said in court. So Pecker urged Trump to pay Cohen his bonus, to which the president-elect replied, "Don't worry about it. I'll take care of it." Once Trump was president, it became harder to keep his skeletons in the closet, Pecker testified. Pecker's deal with McDougal was supposed to keep her quiet, but after the election, he amended the deal to allow her to talk to the press, a move that led Trump to call him in a rage. "You paid her?" Trump asked in astonishment, according to Pecker. He was very upset. He couldn't understand why I did it. Pecker went even further. He extended McDougal's contract to do pieces for his various publications, reasoning that keeping her under contract would ensure that she would not go out and give any further interviews or talk to the press or say negative comments. The executive testified that he explained his rationale for doing so in a phone call with Trump White House advisors Hope Hicks and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, now the Republican governor of Arkansas. Both of them said they thought it was a good idea, Pecker said. The efforts of all the president's subordinates did not assuage Pecker's growing concern that he had put himself in legal jeopardy by helping Trump in the 2016 election. In their cross-examination, Trump's lawyers tried to show the jury that the National Enquirer's arrangement with Trump was not unique to that political campaign, but part of a long history of buying and sometimes suppressing stories about celebrities. Pecker testified about a deal he struck with film star Arnold Schwarzenegger before he ran for governor of California, agreeing to shelve embarrassing stories about the actor. In exchange, Schwarzenegger lent his name to Pecker's workout magazines. The now-retired CEO said that he used photos of Tiger Woods having an extramarital affair to persuade Woods to give an interview and cover photo for a fitness magazine published by Pecker's company and helped suppress negative stories about actor Mark Wahlberg and politician Rahm Emanuel. But with Trump, the stakes were suddenly much higher, Pecker realized. He said he received an alarming letter from the Federal Election Commission in early 2018 and immediately called Cohen. "Why are you worried?" Cohen replied, according to Pecker. "Jeff Sessions is the Attorney General, and Donald Trump has him in his pocket." Pecker said he was not comforted by that claim, and Trump lawyer Emile Bove tried to use that exchange to show that Cohen, who is expected to testify later in the trial as the prosecution's star witness, was simply unreliable. "You were concerned," Bove asked Pecker, "that Michael Cohen had said something to you that wasn't true, because President Trump did not have Jeff Sessions in his pocket?" The lawyer asked Pecker if Cohen was prone to exaggeration. "Yes," Pecker replied. Next, Donald Trump's casual disparagement of prosecutors as evil and crazy. An analysis by Philip Bump. One of the unusual aspects of the jury selection process for Donald Trump's criminal trial in Manhattan is that he was forced to endure the uncommon experience of being with people who don't like him. Jurors who were under consideration for service on the trial were shown their past social media posts and comments disparaging Trump while those comments were read out loud in the courtroom. For Trump, a guy who travels with a staffer whose job duties include printing out positive stories on a mobile printer for him to read, this was an unfamiliar experience. Trump is normally cocooned in a bubble of support. He's at Mar-a-Lago, where people pay money to be near him. He's at Trump Tower, where he is everybody's landlord. He is at a rally where the most ardent fans jockey to be up close to the action. Or he's talking to some sycophantic right-wing media figure offering the standard complaints and claims and nonsense. On Thursday night, the lucky sycophant was Newsmax's Greg Kelly. To establish his sycophancy credentials, he ended the interview by saying, "We're rooting for you, I'm rooting for you, and I know millions of other people are across the world." This is not the most popular show on cable television, pulling in maybe an eighth of the audience of the competition over on Fox News. But that suits Trump's needs just fine. A few hundred thousand people without the scrutiny that comes from appearing on the more heavily watched network. Here, Trump could truly be Trump, and so he was, with no pushback. Had he remained president, which he said he did not because Democrats used COVID to cheat, no pushback, the war with Ukraine would never have happened. Israel, October 7th, would never have happened. No pushback. And without that pushback, a step more, we would never, ever happen. Just wouldn't have happened. Oh, okay. Just wouldn't have. Kelly, the son of former New York City Police Commissioner Ray Kelly, is a particularly outspoken voice on the network. Speaking with Trump on Thursday, he encouraged the former president to explore new rhetorical terrain. Kelly noted that Representative Benny G. Thompson had introduced legislation that would strip Secret Service protection from anyone sentenced to a year or more in prison. His conclusion, these Democrats want you dead, Kelly suggested to Trump. You realize that? Yeah, Trump replied, because I'm the one that turns things around. I'm the one that had the best economy in history. I'm the one, etc., etc. The exchange had a distinct Michael Dukakis addressing capital punishment in 1988 air to it. If Trump really thought that Democrats wanted him dead and that this wasn't simply escalatory rhetoric, it seems safe to assume he'd have been more incensed than to simply slip into campaign patter. It's not that Democrats want him dead. It's that saying Democrats want him dead will enrage and energize viewers on Trump's behalf. At another point in the conversation, Trump fumed about Alvin Bragg, the Manhattan District Attorney, New York Attorney General Letitia James, and Judge Arthur Engoron, who oversaw the trial in which Trump was found to have engaged in rampant fraud. They're evil, you know, Trump said of the officials. They're evil. They're sick. He detoured slightly to suggest that Bragg and James should be addressing other crime instead. Violent crime in New York City is down this year, with murder down almost 20%. Then he returned to his point. These people are crazy. A bit earlier, Kelly had prodded Trump to explain why, despite his promises on the campaign trail in 2016, he never prosecuted Hillary Clinton. I thought it would be a terrible thing for our country, Trump insisted, then contrasting his thoughtfulness with his opponents. They don't care. These people are radical lunatics. They don't care. The actual differentiating factor here, of course, is that Trump engaged in a number of actions that put him at risk of criminal sanction, but avoiding that sort of honesty is precisely why he lives in the bubble. We risk becoming inured to this rhetoric that Trump's opponents want him dead and are evil, crazy, radical lunatics. They skip right over socialism into communism and fascism, he said at another point. It is, in essence, him against the worst people who've ever existed in the United States. Trump's angry commentary about his opponents has been a point of focus for violent actors in the past. The current hyperbole poses the same risk, even as it is morally indefensible on the merits, but it is mostly just background noise to the conversation as the November presidential election nears. It will probably continue to be as long as nothing happens. There's a sort of serendipity for those potential jurors who were excused after having disparaged Trump in the past. Because they expressed dislike for him a few years ago on social media, they don't get to sit in judgment of him now, and they are not included among the targets of opprobrium for his supporters. The prosecutors, as they knew going into this, are not so lucky. Next, how Trump's trial is playing politically. A poll shows Americans are skeptical that the jury's verdict will be fair, but not necessarily for the reasons Trump suggests. And Trump is not proving to be a sympathetic defendant. This by Aaron Blake. In none of Donald Trump's criminal trials do the politics rank as close in importance to the legal issues as they do in Manhattan. The charges in the hush money election interference case are objectively less serious than those in the former president's other cases, and Americans harbor significantly more uncertainty about them. That creates a situation in which the perception of the trial looms especially large, and we now have one of our first good looks at how the trial might be playing politically. A CNN poll suggests that Americans remain skeptical of the process and the trial's importance, but it also suggests that Trump's claims of victimization are still far from prevailing, and that perhaps his own conduct is to blame. The top-line findings from the poll, just 28% say a conviction would disqualify Trump from the presidency, double digits less than those who say that of Trump's three other indictments, and just 33% say he did something illegal. Another 33% say his conduct was unethical but not illegal. Americans say 56 to 44% that they are not confident the jury will reach a fair verdict, but just 34% buy into Trump's claims that he's being treated more harshly than most other criminal defendants. Nearly half say he's either being treated about the same, 13%, or more leniently, 34%. Trump's conduct does not appear to be doing him any favors. Americans say, by a 17-point margin, 42 to 25, that it's been mostly inappropriate rather than mostly appropriate. The rest are undecided. It's worth taking these findings piece by piece. The first isn't terribly surprising. As it lines up with previous polling, Americans are skeptical that Trump broke the law here in a way they simply are not skeptical with his major controversies. They also view this case as involving significantly lower stakes for their November votes. The most relevant and interesting findings are the other three noted above. As to the majority not being confident the verdict will be fair, it's worth asking why that is. Yes, even many Democrats are skeptical of the case. Just 64% of them say they think Trump is guilty. And perhaps this reflects some concern that Manhattan's very blue-leaning population will be biased against a former president from the red side. But it would also seem possible that it is partly about people worrying about Trump getting away with it. Trump has proved slippery when it comes to efforts to hold him accountable in the past, after all, and all it takes is one juror to hold out. Many have noted that a juror has described getting their news from Trump's Truth social media platform. Indeed, the poll shows nearly half of Democrats are not confident in the jury's verdict. Given that nearly two-thirds of them believe that he's guilty, and that another recent poll showed just 4 in 10 Democrats think Trump will be convicted, it would seem like many of them are worried about a lack of accountability. This could also simply reflect Americans' increasingly generalized lack of faith in our legal institutions. An AP-NORC poll last week, for instance, showed low levels of faith not just in the jurors, but also in the judges hearing the cases against Trump and in the U.S. Supreme Court, which brings us to the more Trump-focused findings. Some on the right have pointed to the mere 13% who say Trump is being treated like other defendants, as if it bolsters Trump's claims of persecution. Breitbart gamely claimed that the poll appears to confirm Trump's argument that efforts to bankrupt and throw him in jail are politically motivated. But it shows no such thing. Half of those who think he is not being treated like other defendants say he is actually being treated more leniently, another possible nod to that generalized lack of faith in legal institutions. Fewer than 3 in 10 independents and moderates buy that Trump has been treated more harshly. This poll is merely the latest to suggest Trump's claims to persecution have not really penetrated beyond his devoted base. What does appear to be penetrating, though, and might well undermine Trump's claims to persecution, is the perception that Trump isn't conducting himself properly. While many are reserving judgment, the 17-point margin by which Americans say Trump's behavior is mostly inappropriate rather than appropriate would suggest he's not proving a terribly sympathetic defendant. Strikingly, even the percentage of Republicans who vouch for the appropriateness of Trump's conduct is shy of a majority, 48%. And independents say it has been inappropriate rather than appropriate by a 2-to-1 margin. If that perception continues, it's going to be much tougher for Trump to argue that things like gag orders and decisions that go against him are truly unfair and symptomatic of a weaponized justice system. And if he can't drive that messaging home, the eventual verdict becomes more problematic for him. And now I'm going to move on to the weather. Strong tornadoes are hitting in Nebraska amid storm outbreak in central states. Cities that could be affected by violent storms Friday and or Saturday include Dallas, Oklahoma City, Tulsa, Wichita, Omaha, Des Moines, Milwaukee, and Kansas City, Missouri. That sounds like Cincinnati area might be seeing something of this set of cells sometime Sunday. This story was written by Matthew Capucci. Friday marks the second day of a 4-day barrage of severe storms set to threaten the central states, with the potential for strong tornadoes across portions of the plains and the Corn Belt. Rotating thunderstorms, or supercells, are expected from Nebraska and Iowa to as far south as northeast Texas, and an even more widespread tornado threat may materialize into Saturday from southern Texas to the Great Lakes region. Cities that could be affected by violent storms Friday and or Saturday include Dallas, Oklahoma City, Tulsa, Wichita, Kansas City, Missouri, Omaha, Des Moines, Milwaukee, and Kansas City, Kansas. On Friday afternoon, tornado watches stretched from northeast Texas to eastern Nebraska and southwest Iowa as storms began to erupt. Confirmed tornadoes had already touched down east of Waco, Texas, and in multiple locations in eastern Nebraska, including near Farwell and Elba. Just after 3 p.m. local time, the National Weather Service reported 3 ongoing tornadoes in eastern Nebraska, including a large, intense twister 10 to 15 miles northeast of Lincoln. Dramatic footage of the tornado was captured by storm chasers. The Lancaster County Sheriff's Office said that at around 3, deputies went to a plastics manufacturer northeast of Lincoln to help on a call about a building being hit by a tornado. Upon arriving, they found the building had collapsed and several people were trapped inside. They evacuated the building and 3 people were taken to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries. About 70 employees were inside when the tornado hit. Videos on social media showed tornadoes cutting across Interstate 80 and devastation they had wrecked in and around Elkhorn, which is northwest of Omaha. In one video, a man can be heard saying that the whole neighborhood is gone. At 3 5:41 p.m. local time, the Weather Service declared a tornado emergency for a confirmed large and destructive tornado near Elkhorn, which is just a few miles west of Omaha, until 4:30 p.m. A particularly dangerous situation. Take cover now, the Weather Service warned. Reports from local social media indicate this tornado caused significant damage around Elkhorn. At 4:15 p.m., the tornado emergency was extended into southeast and eastern Blair near the border with Iowa and was in effect until 4:30 p.m. The large twister was moving to the northeast at 30 miles per hour into southwest Iowa. Considerable damage to homes, businesses, and vehicles is likely, and complete destruction is possible, the Weather Service warned. An arcing band of rotating thunderstorms is expected to swing from Omaha to Des Moines into the evening and could extend as far south as Kansas City. All three major cities are encapsulated in a level 3 risk of severe weather drawn by the Weather Service's Storm Prediction Center. The agency warns that all hazards will be possible, including tornadoes with some potentially strong, very large hail over 2 inches in diameter, and wind damage. On Saturday, storms will be more widespread, with at least some risk of severe weather from northern Michigan to the Texas-Mexico border. A tornado is possible anywhere within that zone, but the risk is highest between Kansas and Dallas, including Oklahoma City and Wichita, where a few intense tornadoes could form. While hail was widespread across northwestern Kansas Thursday, tornadoes largely failed to materialize. That was because an outflow boundary, the leading edge of cool air exhaust exiting earlier storms to the northeast, undercut and weakened most of the storms. Subsequently, they struggled to rotate. While hail the size of golf balls to tennis balls was common, tornadoes were not. For the most part, only a few weak landspout tornadoes were observed in northeastern Colorado. The active pattern does not look to ease until the middle of next week, and even that is not a guarantee. Small disturbances in the jet stream could trigger additional rounds of storms, albeit more localized over the plains next week. Next up, King Charles is going to ease back into his public role 3 months after receiving a cancer diagnosis, this by Carla Adam. 3 months after his cancer diagnosis, Britain's King Charles III will ease back into public engagements, starting with a visit to a cancer treatment center in London on Tuesday. His Majesty's treatment program will continue, but doctors are sufficiently pleased with the progress made so far that the King is now able to resume a number of public-facing duties, Buckingham Palace said in a statement Friday evening. Forthcoming engagements will be adapted where necessary to minimize any risks to His Majesty's continued recovery. The King has not disclosed what type of cancer he has or what treatment he has received, other than that it has been on an outpatient basis. He never confirmed Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's suggestion that the cancer was caught early. The palace said Friday that it is too early to say how long his treatment will continue. At least one slightly more distant event has been added to his schedule. At the British government's request, he and Queen Camilla will host the Emperor and Empress of Japan in June, but there was no word on other events that would normally have been baked into his June diary, the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings in France, the monarch's annual birthday parade, and the Royal Ascot Royal horse race. The King and Queen were also widely expected to tour Australia and New Zealand in October as part of a trip coinciding with the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting in Samoa. The palace said that Charles was not expected to carry out a full summer program of events, and that his attendance will be announced nearer the time and subject to doctor's advice. The king is easing back into duty. They don't want to announce too much in advance in case there is a problem with his cancer, said Dicky Arbiter, a former press secretary of Queen Elizabeth II. Arbiter noted that for much of Elizabeth's reign, her attendance at events was announced well in advance, but that changed in her later years. Charles's attendance at even a smattering of public events will still mark a significant change from recent months. Since his diagnosis, the public has caught glimpses of the king here and there. He attended Easter services in Windsor in March, and this month was photographed inspecting soon-to-be-released banknotes with his image on them, but he has largely been out of the public eye, conducting his constitutional duties behind the scenes. His Majesty is greatly encouraged to be resuming some public-facing duties, and very grateful to his medical team for their continued care and expertise, the palace said Friday. The choice of a cancer treatment center, where he will meet staff and patients, is clearly symbolic. It is also the kind of bread-and-butter work that the royals typically do. State visits are more of an undertaking. The monarch normally meets the visiting guests at Horse Guards Parade before traveling back to Buckingham Palace in a carriage procession escorted by mounted soldiers from the household cavalry. That is followed by lunch, an exchange of gifts, and in the evening a state banquet with speeches from both heads of state. Charles's return will be a boost for the British royal family. Catherine, Princess of Wales, has also taken time away from public duties while receiving preventive chemotherapy for cancer, and Prince William only recently returned to his public duties after taking a few weeks off to spend time with her and their family. The palace has not given any updates on Catherine's health since she disclosed her diagnosis in a video in March, saying, "I am well and getting stronger every day." This next piece may have been covered Friday morning, but it has been updated significantly, and so I will read it anew. Blinken warns China to address its support for Russia or, quote, "we will." This by Michael Birnbaum and Christian Shepherd. Chinese and U.S. leaders sought Friday to stabilize their contentious relationship, but Secretary of State Antony Blinken said as he left that there had been no promises on the top U.S. priority of cutting support for Russia's defense industry. Officials on both sides were frank about their differences as they sat for a marathon of meetings that amounted to nearly 6 hours between Blinken and China's top diplomat, Wang Yi. But they also expressed optimism that their conversations were slowly building trust that was leading to improvements in a few areas, such as communications between their militaries and cracking down on chemicals that are used to make fentanyl. Blinken, who also met with Chinese leader Xi Jinping, said the two countries had agreed to hold a formal dialogue for the first time about artificial intelligence to exchange views about a fast-developing technology that each side worries could give the other a formidable military advantage in any confrontation. Even as we seek to deepen cooperation where our interests align, The United States is very clear-eyed about the challenges posed by China and about our competing visions for the future, Blinken told reporters after the meetings. Asked whether Chinese leaders had agreed to restrict their support for Russia's defense industry, which includes machine tools, drone parts, semiconductors, and other items that are key to fueling the Kremlin's war in Ukraine, the top U.S. diplomat gave no indication that there had been progress. Russia would struggle to sustain its assault on Ukraine without China's support, Blinken said. If China does not address this problem, we will, he added, in a possible reference to sanctions against Chinese businesses involved in the trade with Russia. Relations have improved significantly since Blinken last visited 10 months ago, after a Chinese spy balloon's transit across the United States set off an unusually broad national blowback to China's espionage activity. Since then, conversations have become far more routine, enabling the world's two biggest economies and superpower rivals to return to managing their tense but interdependent relationship. We hope the U.S. can look at China's development in a positive light, Xi said as he met Blinken. This is a fundamental issue that must be addressed, just like the first button of a shirt that must be put right in order for the China-U.S. relationship to truly stabilize, improve, and move forward. Blinken's meetings with Wang gave the two sides ample time to air their differences about a host of issues that include reviving military-to-military discussions and China's frosty relationship with Taiwan. But both sides said that holding conversations was a useful step in itself. Welcoming Blinken to the Diaotai State Guesthouse in Beijing, Wang offered a cautious assessment of the discussions. Overall, the China-U.S. relationship is beginning to stabilize, he told Blinken. This is welcomed by our two people. But, Wang said, the negative factors in the relationship are still increasing and building, and the relationship is facing all kinds of disruptions. China's reasonable development rights have been unreasonably suppressed, and our core interests are facing challenges. He warned against engaging in rivalry and confrontation and even sliding toward conflict. Beijing has also complained about U.S. efforts to cut off Chinese access to advanced semiconductors that would enable it to make progress on artificial intelligence that could have military applications. The conversation with Xi was much shorter than that with his foreign minister, but it was a sign of the high degree of importance the two sides gave their fraught dialogue. Xi and President Biden spoke earlier this month by phone and clashed on the subject of export controls, which the Biden administration says are necessary to keep U.S. technology from being used to undermine U.S. security. And Beijing, which complains are simply an effort to restrict its economic rise. Just how successful the U.S. strategy with China will be remains in question, with the United States seeking cooperation in some areas but pushing hard in others. Chinese leaders appear to have little appetite for making concessions elsewhere in the relationship. They complained Friday about a range of U.S. efforts to push back against what the Biden administration says are unfair trade practices, such as subsidies for Chinese industries. The Biden administration says that it is defending U.S. jobs and global rules of open trade. Chinese officials counter that Washington is simply trying to push back on its economic growth with measures such as potential hikes on tariffs on steel and aluminum. For the relationship to move forward, the two sides first need to answer a fundamental question of whether China and the United States are going to be partners or rivals, Wang told Blinken, according to an official Chinese readout released after their meeting. China and the United States have tangled in the South China Sea, where Beijing has made claims that go beyond its internationally recognized waters and pushed against Philippine and other fishing vessels. Biden hosted the leaders of the Philippines and Japan in Washington earlier this month, a dialogue that Chinese leaders have complained is encircling them. Blinken said Friday that Chinese actions in the South China Sea are dangerous. Beijing may also be waiting out the election to make significant shifts in its policies, analysts said, mindful that both Biden and former President Donald Trump have campaigned on tough on China slogans, but have somewhat different demands. There is a U.S. election backdrop in which both Democrats and Republicans gain from tough rhetoric on China, said Wang Huiyao, the president of the Beijing-based Center for China and Globalization. They want China to confront Russia. Yeah, China can, he said, but the U.S. still wants to put China as strategic rival number one. China is not really incentivized. Although Europe appears to have endorsed the broad strokes of Washington's vision, some European nations, notably Germany, still have a more conciliatory approach. German Chancellor Olaf Scholz was in Beijing last week to meet top Chinese leaders, part of an effort that included bolstering trade ties. China is concerned that the United States will continuously raise the bar on what it considers support for Russia's war effort beyond lethal aid to areas Beijing considers normal trade, said Wu Jinbo, dean of the Institute of International Studies at Fudan University in Shanghai. If this time we bow to Blinken's request to stop financial transactions, but the war continues and Ukraine keeps losing ground, then the U.S. will say, China, you should stop doing something else, Wu said. It will be an endless process. The relationship with Russia was just one on a long list of issues the two sides sparred over. The Biden administration worried that fentanyl is the leading cause of death for Americans aged 18 to 45, has been pushing China to crack down on manufacturers of precursor chemicals. U.S. officials feel the issue is one where Beijing could offer some concessions at relatively little cost to itself and might be a basis to build trust for greater cooperation in other areas of the relationship. Blinken brought the State Department's top official focused on narcotics, Todd Robinson, on the trip as a way to show how focused the administration is on the issue. But progress, though meaningful, has been slow, officials say. Chinese officials have also been frustrated with the bill that just passed Congress that requires Chinese-controlled company ByteDance to sell TikTok, although Blinken said Friday that had not been a focus of conversations. And the Biden administration has been pushing Beijing to get more involved in efforts to dial back the conflict in the Middle East, especially in recent weeks as tensions between Israel and Iran threatened to explode into a regional war. Biden administration officials have asked Beijing to use its influence with Iran to get that country to hold back from escalation. This is an area where China has relationships. It has the influence to prevent the conflict from escalating, Blinken told reporters. But Blinken's trip was not exclusively tense meetings with Chinese officials. on his way to the Beijing airport on Friday. He asked his motorcade to make a stop at the Li Pi record store, where he bought two vinyl albums, one by the classic Chinese rock musician Du Wei, and the other a copy of Taylor Swift's Midnights, which he described as a successful American export. Music is the best connector, regardless of geography, said Blinken, who has been known to pick up his guitar at State Department soirees. Next and last, a piece I know I will not be able to finish. As Gaza ceasefire talks resume, the coming fight for Rafah looms large. This by Loveday Morris, Heba Farouk Mahfouz, Claire Parker, Karen DeYoung, and Meg Kelly. Fighting in Gaza began to ebb earlier this month as Israel withdrew most of its ground troops from the enclave. The opening of new border crossings allowed for the entry of more desperately needed aid, and Israeli officials resumed discussions Thursday over a possible ceasefire deal after months of dead-end diplomacy. But any flicker of respite appears fleeting for Gazans as Israel prepares for a bloody showdown with militants in Rafah, the sandy strip of land that is home to more than a million displaced civilians, and according to Israel, the last remaining Hamas battalions. Egypt, desperate to avert fighting along its long, fraught border with Gaza, presented Israeli officials with a new proposal Wednesday to head off a Rafah invasion, according to a former Egyptian official familiar with the negotiations. On Thursday, Israel's war cabinet met to discuss a possible hostage deal, an Israeli official said. Like other current and former officials in this story, they spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive and ongoing talks. An Egyptian delegation was in Israel Friday to continue talks on the proposal, according to reports in Israeli media and the former Egyptian official. The flurry of diplomatic movement comes amid mounting domestic pressure in Israel to bring home the more than 100 hostages still held in Gaza, and growing international alarm over Israel's looming offensive in Rafah, which has Palestinians and aid groups in a nerve-wracking limbo. Israel had intended to present its Rafah plans to the Biden administration in the coming days, the Israeli officials said, though it was unclear if the new diplomatic push might impact the timing. U.S. officials have insisted on a credible plan to evacuate displaced Palestinians, yet most families have already been uprooted multiple times during 200 days of war, and many have no homes to which they can return. Cities in the north have been largely flattened, and the ruins hide unexploded ordnance. Less populated areas in central and coastal Gaza are devoid of shelter and services. Washington has said repeatedly it cannot support a major military operation in Rafah. Israeli officials have described the coming campaign there as inevitable and essential. If necessary, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said last month, we will do it alone. Airstrikes on the southern city have picked up in recent weeks, medics say, adding to the sense of foreboding. New tent encampments in the south and troop deployments are signals of a shifting landscape, yet there is scarce evidence that Israel is prepared to move large numbers of civilians out of Rafah or flood the south with soldiers. Everyone is just waiting in fear, said Marwan al-Hams, director of Abu Yusuf al-Najjar Hospital in Rafah, as the first victims from overnight Israeli strikes began to arrive Thursday night. He said the pace of attacks had escalated over the last 2 weeks after a relative lull during Ramadan. The displaced people do not know where to escape to, he said.
Israel said it must invade Rafah to dismantle Hamas as an organized military force, though the group will likely retain lethal guerrilla capabilities, illustrated by the recent reemergence of fighters in the north. Military officials believe Hamas's top leaders, including Yahya Sinwar, the architect of the October 7th attacks, and many of Israel's 130 remaining hostages, are holed up in tunnels beneath the city. Hamas gave a reminder of its leverage on Wednesday, releasing a video with the first proof of life of American-Israeli hostage Hirsch Goldberg-Polan, who was 23 when he was kidnapped from the Nova Music Festival. It was screened by Israelis' war cabinet during their meeting on Thursday, local media reported, amid near-daily protests by hostage families and their supporters. U.S. officials have said they do not think an offensive is imminent, and conditions on the ground appear to support that assessment. The Israel Defense Forces Wednesday said it was ready to deploy two reserve brigades for missions in the Gaza Strip, but that would still leave the military well short of the force levels needed to sustain a major operation. "We'd need troops," said Jonathan Conricus, a senior fellow at Foundation for Defense of Democracies and an IDF spokesman earlier in the war. But he noted Israel's recent efforts under American pressure to address Gaza's hunger crisis, allowing more aid trucks to cross and working with the United Nations to reopen bakeries in the north. An IDF engineering unit, which has been practicing on an Israeli beach with U.S. military counterparts, will secure a U.S.-built floating pier in central Gaza, a senior U.S. defense official told reporters Thursday. The pier is expected to be up and running in early May, the official said, with an estimated 90 trucks per day supplying food and medical supplies. Improving the situation in the north, where experts have warned a famine may already be underway, is key to winning U.S. support for a Rafah operation, Conricus said. To get people out of fighting before fighting begins, and to have a credible action plan to deal with providing humanitarian aid, he said, that is the focal American demand. The volume of aid reaching Gaza is significantly greater than in previous months, David Satterfield, the U.S. Special Envoy for Middle East Humanitarian Issues, told reporters this week, describing it as progress, but not enough. Any offensive in Rafah would likely shut down the city's border crossing with Egypt, which has been the main route for aid deliveries during the war. The lack of clarity on Israel's military operation and when it will be put in motion has left aid agencies guessing. Contingency planning is a strong word because there is no plan, said Bob Kitchen, VP for Emergencies at the International Rescue Committee, in an interview earlier this month after a trip to Gaza. If there was an obvious candidate for where people would be moved to, then sure, we could plan. One of many unanswered questions, Kitchen said, is how humanitarian staff will be able to enter or exit Gaza if Rafah is off limits. In the meantime, the organization is establishing a base in Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Assuming the plan goes forward, a lot of people are going to have to move from the south, he said. And that's all my time for today. This is Dave Abbott. This has been The Washington Post. Thanks so much for listening, and let's be careful out there.